Now, it won't surprise you to know I'm very excited. But I'm really excited today because I just think it's such a privilege to be able to welcome Patrick to come here today. Pat has been very instrumental in my call to ministry and a really special friend on my journey over around the last 10 years. So it is a real pleasure and privilege for me to have Pat here. So I'd like to invite Pat to the front. I know that some of you know Pat and you know a bit about Pat, but I thought it would be good for us to get to know Pat a little bit more. So, Pat, we know that you used to be a member here for a little while. Could you tell us when you were here and what are your connections to the area around here?
Well, my connections go back to when I was little. I was born out at a little place called Little Worley. I don't know if anyone knows that. And I went to school at the Ursuline in Brentwood. And I was a member here just for about 2 years during the time my first baby was born in St. John's. And Chris Norrish came and saw me in hospital, and he dedicated her. And I didn't tell you, but I learnt to drive around here, around the Army and Navy.
Wow.
And there's a road round the back of Marconi's with a cam like that, where I had to turn a large Peugeot and face it in the opposite direction. So I have strong memories of Chelmsford. But this was not like this, of course, in those days.
And from then, you went into Baptist ministry, mm-hmm. and I know you've done a whole variety of things. Tell us a bit about the ministry that you've been involved in.
Well, I haven't done a great range, because I was called to a church in Leytonstone. Well, actually, it was just about where the Olympic Park is now. So my children can say that they ran around the Olympic Stadium. But, of course, in those days it was a muddy field, but it became the Olympic Stadium. So I was a minister there for 13 years, very happily, loved it there. And then I became, and this is my only claim to fame, I'm the only woman ever to have been a superintendent.
Wow.
General superintendent and metropolitan superintendent. So you could kid the children that you were in the police, which was fun. And so I was Metropolitan Superintendent and then became the team leader for the London Baptist Association, which I did for another 13 years after that, which was great fun.
And I'm sure there were many things that happened. Mm. Any particular highlights of ministry or passions that you've still got?
Well, I think the most exciting thing was to be in London and in the London churches, when people were coming here from all around the world. And so, whereas many parts of the country have had to see churches closed, but in London we were squeezing them into every space you could find, you know. So we had a church, that worshipped in the hall of the Hindu temple in Tooting, but they charged a rather high rent, so then they got the basement of the billiard hall down the road. And they ended up over Iceland, I think. But we had churches squeezed into every available space and coming from all parts of the world. And this was such a blessing. I mean, God was so good to us here because people were coming bringing a very optimistic and creative understanding of what change the church can make and should be making in the society where it's placed. And so that very positive kind of, creative front foot descent, I would call it. And that was great. Yeah.
Fantastic. And what about now? What are you up to now?
Well, I retired 3 years ago now and moved to North Yorkshire. This was not because I was tired of life in London. I'm never tired of life in London, but I couldn't afford life in London. So, and I can afford life in a very beautiful place called Robin Hood's Bay. There you go, see. If anyone does the coast-to-coast walk, you will walk past my house. And it's a lovely place to live. It's quite lively. Lots of school parties come down. And I'm involved in supporting two Baptist churches in Scarborough down the coast, and I'm involved in the village with a weekly communion and with school assemblies and you name it. And I'm still travelling around. So, yes, I'm still busy, but it's wonderful.
Really retired.
Well, no, I mean, I'm not quite sure what that word means, you know. I think it's post-dated, that word.
Absolutely. Well, we are delighted that you have travelled from Yorkshire to be with us and
Thank
spend
you.
Today with us. And Pat will be coming to speak with us in a moment. But first, if I can invite Tim and Lou to come and join us. Is it Tim and Lou? No, it's not. It's just Lou.
Okay, the reading is taken from Luke chapter 16, verses 1 to 8. Jesus said to his disciples, "There was once a rich man who had a servant who managed his property. The rich man was told that the manager was wasting his master's money. So he called him and said, 'What is this I hear about you? Hand in a complete account of your handling of my property, because you cannot be my manager any longer.' The servant said to himself, 'My master is going to dismiss me from my job. What shall I do? I'm not strong enough to dig ditches, and I'm ashamed to beg. Now I know what I will do. Then when my job is gone, I shall have friends who will welcome me in their homes.' So he called in all the people who were in debt to his master. He asked the first one, 'How much do you owe my master?' 100 barrels of oil, he answered. 'Here is your account,' the manager told him. 'Sit down and write 50. Then he asked another one, 'And you, how much do you owe?' 1,000 sacks of wheat, he answered. 'Here is your account,' the manager told him. 'Write 800. As a result, the master of this dishonest manager praised him for doing such a shrewd thing, because the people of this world are much more shrewd in handling their affairs than the people who belong to the light.' This is the word of the Lord.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me today, especially on your anniversary day. And this church does its anniversaries properly. You have cake. Sometimes I go to an anniversary and there's no cake. I mean, what a disappointment. But you have many cakes, I gather, so even better. But it's lovely to be with you. When Lisa got in touch, she said it was a time of great change for this church. Everything is changing around you as well, with the new flats going up and the town on the move, which is exciting but can be a little unnerving. But what I want to talk about today is those things that don't change. Within an anniversary, there are a variety of different emphases. There are thanks for the past and plans for the future. But I think the heart of an anniversary is the reminder of who we are, what we are here for, what the point of this church is. What do you exist for? And I want to look at that, looking at two parables of Jesus. Now, these are both teasing parables, really. And parables are all riddles, aren't they? They're things that, stories that you hear and that you sit down and you think, well, yes, but what does that mean? And I hope you have opportunities in this church to sit and do that and say, well, I think he was, but no, I think, and all join in the debate. What was Jesus really talking about? And so I've chosen two parables to think about today, which are both of them particularly teasing, riddles, difficult riddles. What did Jesus mean? And this first one is really quite a fascinating one. I love this parable. It's called all kinds of different things. Parable of the unjust steward, the dishonest manager, all sorts of different titles you see to it. And it comes from a time when there were a great many absentee landlords in the Roman Empire in general and in Palestine at the time. Lots of absentee landlords. They had been given the land. Maybe they were working, maybe they were soldiers up on the wall, up on Hadrian's Wall. Never been anywhere near Palestine. But they were promised when they retired, they would be given a plot of land as a veteran, as a retired veteran. If you made it to retirement, you would be given a plot of land, and it was waiting for you somewhere in the empire. Could be anywhere. Or sometimes people moved off the land to go to the big urban centers of administration and of finance and all of that sort of thing. So lots of different reasons. And if you got into trouble with the Roman Empire, if you couldn't pay your taxes, or you did something you shouldn't have done, your land would be confiscated and given to somebody else. So as a result of all these things, there were lots of estates where there was a landlord that nobody knew and had never met and lived far away and probably would never come home anyway. But they were managed by maybe one of the tenant farmers or maybe a manager just employed to do that. And his job was every year to collect the dues, corn, wine, oil, money maybe, and save it up so that when eventually the landlord comes home, he's got all this stuff waiting for him. That's what they were supposed to do. But you can see how it was, can't you? I mean, supposing this landlord was a centurion up on Hadrian's Wall, and you'd be thinking to yourself, well, even if he gets out of the army in one piece, he's never going to make his way here. We can live as if we didn't have a landlord. We can live as if there were no dues to be collected, no debts to be paid. We can just do what we want, really. And this was what this man was doing. And Jesus uses this figure a lot in his parables, the figure of the manager, the steward, the senior servant, who has responsibility. And there will be a day of reckoning. There will be an accounting one day. One day there will. But you put it off and you put it off and you put it off and you kid yourself that it won't happen. And of course, what Jesus is saying is that with his arrival, the day of judgment, the day of reckoning, the accounting day has come. Now is the day. What have you done with those things that were entrusted to you? Your gifts, your skills, your strength, your affluence, your education, your friendship networks, your family. What have you done with all that you were entrusted with? The day of accounting has come. And this is a theme that runs through all of these parables of Jesus. And very often you end up with the unjust, lazy, cruel, abusive, whatever it is, steward getting his comeuppance. He's out there in the darkness. In one case, he was torn to shreds. Different images of punishment, different images of banishment. He gets his comeuppance. The day of reckoning has come. But here, it's the opposite. Here, he gets away with it. Here, he cooks the books, and he gets away with it. And his Lord commends him. Now, what's going on here? You can imagine the people who first listened to this thinking, can't be right. That can't be right. This man's a swindler. How could he get away with that? So it gets them thinking. But I think if we want to understand this particular story, we need to see it in its setting. Well, you always need to look at the setting, don't you? What's been going on beforehand and what goes on afterwards in Luke's gospel? Well, what we have here is a passage that begins at the beginning of Luke 15 and runs halfway through Luke 16. It begins like this. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering round Jesus to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." So they complained. Then we have four stories. And then right at the end, we have these dreadful words in chapter 16, verse 15. "You, Pharisees, are those who justify yourselves in the sight of others, but God knows your hearts. And what is prized by human beings is an abomination in the sight of God." That is very powerful. That is a very powerful condemnation of the Pharisees. So what goes on between those two verses. That brings that particular passage to an end. What goes on in between? We have four stories. Pharisees and the lawgivers understood the world as divided into two kinds of people, good and bad, righteous and unrighteous, respectable and reprobate, acceptable and unacceptable, included and excluded. This is how they functioned. There were certain standards that must be upheld, and if you didn't uphold those standards, then you were put out of the community. The publicans, the sinners, the prostitutes, the quislings, the people who were in cahoots with the Roman occupying army. You can understand the hatred that there would be for them. The black marketeers. They were not welcome in anyone's home. You were not to eat with them and probably not to speak with them. They were outcast, cast out. And deliberately so, unrightly so, because you've got to have standards, haven't you? You've got to have boundaries. If you have no standards and no boundaries, where's the moral compass for society? Everything goes to the dogs. So the Pharisees said. Now, you've got to have your standards. And I'm sure that many of you maybe have felt that and certainly have heard it. But if there are no boundaries, if there are no clear demarcation between what's good and what's bad, then everyone's at sea. So you can understand why they felt like that. It's perfectly understandable and in some ways quite correct. We have, after all, 10 commandments. We're supposed to keep them. If you don't keep them, you create mayhem for everybody. They must be taught and they must be upheld. And there must be some sanction towards those who break them. This was the view of the Pharisees and the lawgivers. And it's not, after all, such a bad view. But Jesus kept stepping over the boundaries. He kept blurring the edges. He kept accepting the unacceptable. He kept company with the people you were not supposed to keep company with, which put him now on the outside, didn't it? After all, we're known by the company we keep, aren't we? If you keep company with blackguards, you must be a blackguard. If you keep company with drunks, debauchees, if you keep company, well, it shows the kind of person you are. And Jesus was keeping company with these kinds of people. And they complained. And in reply, Jesus tells four stories. And the first two stories he tells, the story of the lost sheep and the story of the lost coin, are both stories which reveal what God himself is like. And Jesus was saying, I understand why you feel you have to have these boundaries, but God doesn't have those boundaries. God has no insiders and outsiders, no included and excluded. He doesn't do that. Every single human being made in his image is precious, and he will go and seek and save the lost at no matter what cost. There is nobody so messed up, so vicious, so impossible, so smelly, so filthy. There is nobody that is beyond the reach of his compassion and his love that he does not want to bring safe home. Not for God, that attitude, which very occasionally, I'm sure not in this church, but I have occasionally encountered about the really awkward squad, you know, the quarrelsome, difficult, cantankerous people when they leave the church. Well, we're better off without them. We are not better off without them. We are not. Life might be more comfortable. But God seeks and saves the lost. His heart is for the lost. The 99 that are safely inside, they're okay. It's that one He seeks and saves the lost. And so these two stories tell us, if you want to be like God, and the Pharisees wanted to be children of the light, you saw how that verse comes at the end. They perceived themselves as children of the light, you see. And they wanted to be godly people. Then this is what God is like. God would be having dinner with the Pharisees and the publicans, and God is. So first two. Next story, famous story. Story of the lost sons, of the two sons who were lost. Isn't it extraordinary how even in modern translations, there's a heading there, the prodigal son, which buys into exactly what the Pharisees believed. It's not about a prodigal son, it's about two lost sons. They are both lost. And in both cases, the father has to go out into the darkness and fetch them home. Neither of them have any understanding at all of what it means to be a son of the father. The youngest one sees his father as a milch cow, really. He'd get all his money off him, he goes off, he wastes it all. He only comes home because he wants a meal ticket. He doesn't come home because he's concerned for his parents, you know. He comes home for a meal. And yet, the father runs down the path, flings his arms around him, puts the best robe on him, has a party. The other son, equally ignorant of what it means to live together in love, sees his father as a slave driver. All these years I've slaved for you and never disobeyed a single order that you gave me, but you didn't give me so much as a goat to have a party with my friends. And now this son of yours has come back after wasting all your money on his tarts, and you throw a party for him. Bitter, angry, jealous, resentful, hate-filled man. He doesn't feel glad that his brother has come home safe and sound. He wishes he were dead. Full of hatred. Two lost sons. One reprobate, like the Pharisees, like the publicans and the sinners. One respectable, like the Pharisees, equally lost. Both lost. Both needing grace and forgiveness and compassion and love. Needing to be brought back to life. Needing to be shown what it means to be a child of this father. Both of them. So Jesus is saying to the Pharisees, the world is not divided into two kinds of people. There is one kind of person. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. All. Some do it spectacularly. Some through little day-to-day meannesses and pettiness. Some through cowardice and laziness. But all sin and fall short of the glory of God. We don't love him with all our heart and soul and mind and strength. And we don't love each other the way we love ourselves. We have all sinned. So then he moves on to this last story. He says, if that is true, now how should we treat each other? Now, how should we behave towards those around us that fall short? And he tells this lovely story. This steward, he is a sinner. He's a serious sinner. He is a swindler. He is a blackguard. He is cooking the books. Probably easier to do with Roman numerals, isn't it? Because if you've got a 10, you can just put two ones in front of it, and there you've got 8 instead. So it works quite nicely with Roman numerals. You can just, you know, cook the books. So he says to his neighbors, what are we going to do? Day of reckoning has come. I didn't think it would ever happen, but it has happened. So now what are we going to do? Because I can't pay the debt that I owe, and you can't pay the debt that you owe. We're in a mess. I'll tell you what we'll do. Let's put together as much as we can get and hope that he doesn't notice. If we get enough corn in the barn and enough wine in the cellar, maybe he won't look at the books and add it up and realize how far short we've fallen. Maybe we can pull the wool over his eyes a bit. So you give me as much as you can, and you give me as much as you can, you give me as much as you can, and I'll cook the books and we'll see how we get on. And so that's what he does. And the landlord comes along, and of course he's not fooled at all. But he says, yeah, that was a very sensible thing to do. That was very sensible. At least I've got something, haven't I? But what is Jesus really saying? Surely what he is really saying is this. Not a single one of us could stand a strict accounting. We cannot stand a strict accounting. If God were to say to us, here is your life, and here is all that was given, and here are all the opportunities, and here was each day of your life, how did you live it? And expected us to have lived our lives with the love, the integrity, the generosity, the courage that he reveals. How far short do we fall? We have sinned and we fall short. All of us. There is no one human being who could stand before God on a day of strict accounting. Now, if that is the case, then we need his grace, his forgiveness, his compassion, his generosity. We need him to turn a blind eye, if you like. We need him to make allowances. We need him to look at us through spectacles that are tinted with love. We need that from him. But then our neighbor also needs it from us. Because if I need allowances made for my failings, then I am required to make allowances for yours. I have no right to expect of you a level of perfection that I can't live. I mean, I am full of good intentions. I want to do the best. I make good resolutions. I try hard. But, you know, I will let you down. At some time or other, I will let you down. Well, I won't, because I'm out of here and back on the train. So you won't know how far short I fall. But the people I work with will know. And the day will come when I will let them down, when I will disappoint them. The day will come when I will forget something really important. And I will overlook something. And the day will come when I will think to myself, I can't be bothered. Because I am just a human being, and so are you. And there is something about a humanity, there's something about a realism, a maturity, and something about a humility that does not expect from other people that they should be superhuman. And when they let us down, and they forget, and they offend us, and they upset us, and they pass us in the street, not because they meant to be rude, but because their mind was on something else. Or when they do something a bit more spectacular and really mess our lives up. And we need to understand that they too have many good intentions and hopes and dreams and wanted to be the best, but just fell short of the mark. They just fell short of the mark. And that's the truth. And that's how it is with human beings. I remember part of the job that I used to have to do was to speak to ministers when they had done something that was called conduct unbecoming. And conduct unbecoming meant the end of their ministry. And I can understand why. Because it's a job that's full of trust. You have to be able to trust someone. You have to be able to trust someone with the pastoral responsibility. But there were times when I would think to myself, he's just a human being. He's just a human being. He's messed it up. And you would break your heart over people, you know? We are just human. And we are called to live and walk and function and speak in a universe of grace. In a world that is very censorious, that loves nothing better than turning over stones and finding underneath them some worm or other and plastering it over the newspapers. We live in that kind of world, and we are called to be different. To function with grace and kindness and understanding, and not to expect of other people standards we cannot keep ourselves. I think that's what this parable is all about. I think it brings that series of four to a conclusion, and it says to the Pharisees, everybody's lost, including you, and God has come to seek and find everybody, including you. He will forgive all your sins if you forgive your brother from your heart. It's either grace for everyone or it's grace for no one. If you know you need it, you need to give it. And you need to do it. May it be so. Amen.